Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Dorothy Gundy and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Dorothy Gundy.
Throughout the United States, people are concerned about voting and ballot counting in the presidential election next month. But it is hard to top the levels of concern in the eastern state of Pennsylvania. The city of Philadelphia is home to 20% of all Pennsylvania voters likely to support Democratic Party candidates. U.S. President Donald Trump has described Philadelphia as a place where bad things happen. Trump's political campaign has taken election officials in the city to court. They were forced to explain security measures after election equipment disappeared from a building where it was stored. There is an investigation into military ballots that were mistakenly thrown away in one Pennsylvania county. In Harrisburg, the state capital, lawmakers are fighting over the way to count the large number of mailed-in ballots. Pennsylvania is trying to hold the election in an environment where Republicans and Democrats believe the other side wants to steal the election. State and local election officials say they are doing all they can to make sure the voting is fair. They recall the counting of ballots in Florida 20 years ago, when the presidential election was decided in the U.S. Supreme Court. For years, we have trusted our election officials to be nonpartisan. Why should we suddenly not trust them? Said Eileen Olmsted. She is with the League of Women Voters of Pennsylvania, a nonpartisan group. It works to increase people's involvement in government. Olmsted added that there is no evidence of any voter wrongdoing in the state. Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden was born in Pennsylvania. He has visited it more than any other state since September 1st. Kantar Semag watches the amount of money the candidates spend on political advertising. It says the political campaigns have spent more on television ads in Pennsylvania than any other state, except Florida. Pennsylvania has 20 electoral votes. Republican activists have made it clear that they will look at the legitimacy of each ballot before they will admit defeat. States are given electoral votes based on their population. A presidential candidate must win 270 electoral votes to win the election. Suzanne Almeida is with Common Cause Pennsylvania, another nonpartisan group. She says, "We are seeing the kind of incidents that are likely to happen in every election be blown up to mean there is something wrong with the state's election administration. There are any number of reasons why that's not true," she added. The biggest difficulty may be verifying and counting the large number of mail-in ballots. Election officials expect more than 3 million state residents will vote by mail because of fear of the coronavirus. 4 years ago, only 300,000 people voted by mail. In Pennsylvania, election officials are not permitted to start counting the votes until Election Day. A attempts to change that law have been blocked by the Republican-controlled state legislature. So the vote count will continue for days after the November 3rd election. It could delay a final result in the presidential election. Yet, for all the accusations and investigations, many Pennsylvania residents say they have not had any problems registering and voting. There is hope that all will go well on Election Day. Susan Sterling is a university academic advisor. She decided to vote early at one of the city's election centers. It went really quickly and smoothly, she said. But that may change. There are several legal cases before judges that will decide which ballots get counted. One case is about whether to count mailed-in ballots that arrive late. Another is about efforts to limit the number of places to drop off a marked ballot. These cases can cause confusion and other problems for election officials. Confusion does not promote safe, accessible, and secure elections, said Witold J. Walczak. He serves as legal director for the nonprofit American Civil Liberties Union. Republicans and the Trump campaign say they are only trying to protect the fairness of the election. His position was, we have to have an election that is fair and that every vote is counted and counted the right way, said Bernadette Comfort, Trump's state campaign chair. Democrats use the same argument to criticize Republicans, who they say are trying to steal the election. Mail-in ballots come with a secrecy sleeve that covers the outside of the ballot. Many voters throw away the sleeve and simply put their ballot in the envelope. Republicans say these ballots should not be counted. That's voter suppression, said State Representative Malcolm Kenyatta, a Democrat from Philadelphia. But election officials are pressing forward, hoping that Election Day and the weeks that follow are calm. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
A space object recently discovered as a possible asteroid may actually be an old rocket from a failed moon landing attempt in the 1960s. Astronomers observed the object last month through a telescope based in Hawaii. The scientists documented the object as an asteroid that was on its way toward Earth. Searching for such objects is common among astronomers as part of international efforts aimed at protecting Earth against asteroid hits. The object was given the name 2020SO. It was added to the International Astronomical Union's Minor Planet Center's list of asteroids and comets found in our solar system. Currently, the list is just a little under 1 million. But the American space agency NASA's leading asteroid expert, Paul Chodas, says he believes the newly discovered object is not an asteroid at all. Instead, he believes the object is a piece of space junk. Chodas has suggested that the object is likely the old booster rocket that successfully pushed NASA's Surveyor 2 lander to the moon in 1966. I'm pretty jazzed about this, Chodas told the Associated Press. It's been a hobby of mine to find one of these and draw such a link. Chodas has been studying asteroids for many years. He is currently director of the Center for Near-Earth Object Studies at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. Surveyor 2 was a robotic spacecraft that crashed into the moon after one of its engines failed to start during the trip. The rocket, named Centaur, kept flying past the moon as planned and became space junk. The object being observed is estimated to be about 8 meters long based on its brightness. That is about the size of the old Centaur rocket. Chodas said the first thing that caught his attention was the object's near-circular orbit around the Sun, which is very similar to Earth's. Such behavior is unusual for an asteroid. Chodas said the movement represented flag number one that the object is not an asteroid. The mysterious object is also in the same plane as Earth, not positioned above or below. That was the second red flag for Chodas, since asteroids usually travel at uneven angles. Lastly, Chodas said the object is coming toward Earth at about 2,400 kilometers an hour, which is considered very slow for an asteroid. As the object gets closer to Earth, astronomers should be able to better follow its orbit and observe how much it is pushed around by radiation and heat effects of the Sun. If it is an old empty rocket, it will move differently than a heavy space rock that is not as affected by outside forces. The movements are how astronomers usually tell the difference between asteroids and space junk, such as used rocket parts. Chodas said there are likely numerous fake asteroids out there, but if the movements of the objects cannot be effectively observed or measured, it is difficult to confirm their exact identities. Sometimes, however, it can be the other way around. In 1991, Chodas and others identified a mystery object as an asteroid rather than space junk, even though its orbit around the Sun was very similar to Earth's. In 2002, Chodas discovered what he believes was the leftover Saturn V booster rocket from 1969's Apollo 12, the second moon landing by NASA astronauts. He admits the evidence was circumstantial given the object's one-year orbit around Earth. The object was never documented as an asteroid and left Earth's orbit in 2003. But Chodas says the latest object's path is more direct and much more stable, which strengthens his theory. "I could be wrong on this. I don't want to appear overly confident," he said. "But it's the first time, in my view, that all the pieces fit together with an actual known launch." Cary Nugent is an asteroid hunter at Olin College of Engineering in Needham, Massachusetts. She said Chodas' theory is a good one based on strong evidence. Nugent is the writer of the 2017 book Asteroid Hunters. "Some more data would be useful so we can know for sure," she told the AP in an email. Asteroid hunters from around the world will continue to watch this object to get that data. I'm excited to see how this develops, she added. I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. In the middle of the 1850s, the United States was again struggling with the issue of slavery. The dispute centered increasingly on Kansas, a territory in the middle of the country. In Kansas, white men were able to vote on whether they wanted slavery to be legal in the territory. Many Kansas settlers opposed slavery. Some of the settlers were Northern abolitionists. They believed that owning another person was immoral. Many farmers also opposed legalizing slavery. They did not want to compete with slave labor. But many people in the nearby state of Missouri wanted Kansas to permit slavery. Slavery was legal in Missouri, and many Missouri slave owners wanted to live next to a territory where slavery was legal. So when Kansas held elections, pro-slavery men from Missouri crossed the border and voted illegally. Yet their votes were accepted.
The result of the territorial elections is that you have a territorial legislature that is overwhelmingly pro-slavery. It will write a slave code for Kansas. It will say Kansas is a slave territory. Slavery is protected here.
Nicole Etchison is a historian. She says the newly elected Kansas legislature created strong laws to protect slavery in the territory. The laws said no Kansan could speak or write against slavery. And they said people who tried to help slaves escape could be put in jail or executed. The lawmakers also demanded that President Franklin Pierce dismiss the territory's governor, who opposed slavery. The president agreed. He appointed a pro-slavery governor instead. Anti-slavery settlers in Kansas grew angry. They felt they could not get fair treatment from the president or the new governor. They said pro-slavery groups cheated to control the elections. So the anti-slavery settlers took an extreme step. They formed their own government. Their political group was known as the Free State Party. Its members wrote their own constitution. They also chose their own governor. Historian Nicole Etchison says Free State members refused to recognize the bogus authority of the official Kansas legislature.
That is the argument that the free state political movement will make, not so much that slavery is an awful thing, although some of them make that argument, but that free white settlers in Kansas have had their political rights at the ballot box denied.
President Pierce said the actions of the Free State Party seemed revolutionary. He said that if party members attacked any government property or official, party leaders should be charged with treason. Pierce gave the pro-slavery governor of Kansas control of troops at two army bases in the territory. The situation threatened to turn violent at any time. In November 1855, a pro-slavery man killed a free state man in a dispute over land claims. To answer the attack, free state settlers threatened the killer and burned his house. At the same time, hundreds of pro-slavery men crossed the border from Missouri. They planned to burn the town of Lawrence, where many Free State members lived. The pro-slavery governor and the Free State governor agreed to hold an emergency meeting. They negotiated a settlement, and the men from Missouri went home. But the truce did not last long. In the weeks that followed, a pro-slavery sheriff attempted to arrest the leaders of the Free State government, but failed. A few days later, the law enforcement official was shot. Around the same time, a pro-slavery grand jury found several Free State leaders guilty of treason. The grand jury also said the town of Lawrence was supporting illegal newspapers and a hotel that stored weapons. Pro-slavery officials moved to take control of the town. The wounded sheriff urged private citizens to help. Once again, hundreds of men, including many from Missouri, gathered in Kansas. Once again, the target was Lawrence. This time, however, there was no truce. On May 21, 1856, a group of pro-slavery men marched into the town. Historian David Potter describes the incident in his book, The Impending Crisis. He says the mob entered Lawrence with flags and flying banners as if it were a victorious army. Some men threw two newspaper printing presses into the river. Others freed as much alcohol as they could find. And Potter writes, the group turned five cannons on the Free State Hotel. The mob fired the cannons at the hotel and burned the house where the Free State governor lived. But no anti-slavery settlers were killed. The only person killed was a pro-slavery man. He died when part of the Free State Hotel fell on him. Anti-slavery newspapers called the attack the Sack of Lawrence. In other words, they suggested that pro-slavery raiders had completely destroyed the town. A settler named John Brown heard about the attack on Lawrence. Brown was from the eastern state of Connecticut, but he had recently moved to Kansas. He strongly opposed slavery. He also thought the Free State government was too weak. So John Brown persuaded four of his sons, his son-in-law, and two other men to answer the Sack of Lawrence. Brown believed that the battle against the forces of slavery must continue, and he believed that God had chosen him to lead it. Late at night, Brown and the other men went to a settlement near Pottawatomie Creek. They went to three homes and seized five pro-slavery men.
Took these men out of their beds, defenseless, unarmed, and hacked them to death with broadswords.
Historian Nicole Etchison explains that Brown's group seized the men, murdered them, and left their bodies next to the creek. The event became known as the Pottawatomie Massacre. The combination of the Sack of Lawrence and the Pottawatomie Massacre frightened both pro- and anti-slavery forces. Both sides believed they could be attacked at any time. They began collecting weapons to defend themselves. In the summer and autumn of 1856, the competing forces repeatedly threatened each other. They forced each other off land. They burned each other's houses. More people were killed. The territory became known as Bleeding Kansas. Nicole Etchison says the term Bleeding Kansas was evocative. In other words, it made people feel strongly.
The term is so evocative because it's a propaganda term.
Ms. Etchison says that many people, especially in the North, were against slavery in the territory. These individuals used the term Bleeding Kansas in their newspapers to gain support for their cause. The Kansas-Nebraska Act and the violence that followed also gave birth to a new political party. Its members called themselves Republicans. The Republican Party was an unusual combination of groups. It included former Democrats who were angry that their party had supported the Kansas-Nebraska Act. They believed the Democrats were allowing slavery to expand. The Republicans also included members of the old Whig Party. The Whig Party had lost badly in the elections of 1852 because its members could not agree on whether slavery should be legal. Anti-slavery Whigs found a new home in the Republican Party. The Republican Party of the 1850s also included voters who did not support immigrants, especially Irish Catholics. These nativist Republicans wanted to protect the rights of American Protestants. All Republicans were united, however, in their opposition to slavery in the Kansas and Nebraska territories. Some Republicans were abolitionists. They wanted to ban slavery everywhere in the United States. But the majority of Republicans had no interest in ending slave labor in the South. They simply did not want slavery to spread to other areas. Nicole Etchison says that white Southerners did not respond well to the new party. They believed that all Republicans were like John Brown, the anti-slavery settler who had murdered five pro-slavery men.
White Southerners do not see the distinction between a Republican Party that says, we don't like slavery, it's immoral, it shouldn't expand, and a John Brown who says, I don't like slavery, it's immoral, and it ought to be overturned by violence.
In 1854, some Republicans from the state of Illinois asked a politician named Abraham Lincoln to serve on their committee. Lincoln refused. He did not like slavery, but he still supported the Whig Party. 2 years later, in 1856, the Republicans nominated a presidential candidate for the first time. He was John C. Fremont. Fremont had explored the American West. He had been a senator from California. He was young and exciting. Republicans thought he was the right man to lead their young and exciting party. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History, from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.